You're listening to the North American Francophone Podcast, hosted in English by Claire-Marie Brisson and proudly recorded in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the North American Francophone Podcast. I'm your host, Claire-Marie, and today's episode is going to discuss Francophone North America and the relations with North American Francophones and policymakers. At the end of this episode, you'll hear a conversation with Max Bone, research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Progress and student at the Elliott School of International Affairs in Washington, D.C., as we dialogue about Francophone African and Anglophone African issues and how they relate to North America. Today's episode starts with a little challenge. I'd like for you to imagine that you've just entered an American high school and you're walking through the hallways and suddenly come across the French classroom. You open the door and you look around the classroom. What do you see? What's on the walls? How is French represented? Now, for most of you, you're probably immediately thinking of Eiffel Towers, baguettes, and maybe a smattering of photos that represent France and other Francophone countries. But the first thing that comes to mind is really France-centric. Oftentimes in high schools, French teachers have a fascination and a true passion for France. They may have been to Paris when they were young or studied abroad, and they bring that passion to their students in the classroom. But the reality is that the future of French is African. In an article published by the BBC in April 2019, we are reminded that the same kind of customs and traditions, say for example going to a boulangerie for a baguette, are very much present in Francophone Africa. And if we think about numbers, the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie, or the International Francophone Organization, estimates that there are 96.2 million French speakers in Africa out of a total of 220 million French speakers worldwide. This is just going to increase as the years go on, and it's projected that 85% of French speakers could live in Africa by 2050. And as French becomes the lingua franca of African nations, there's another reality that's at play: the loss of other languages and the conflictual relationships that exist between them. French is becoming the lingua franca, but that doesn't mean that it's the native language of people who are living in African countries. It can be the second or even third language for most of its speakers in Africa. The French used from country to country is mixed with local phraseology that distinguishes itself very much from what is spoken in France and across the Francophone world. As a French instructor myself, I was very curious to understand what the policy and cultural situation was surrounding French in Africa at this time, and I didn't think that I could answer all of the policy questions given my admittedly limited knowledge of Francophone Africa. And so I contacted a research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Progress in Washington, D.C., to better be able to dialogue about these issues and understand what the relationship is between African Francophones and how French is used on a day-to-day basis. I was mostly interested in understanding what political and social relationships might exist, given that French is a colonial language for African speakers. I was also curious to understand if there were linguistic conflicts or resentment to speaking French in Africa, and I was quite surprised at the responses given to me in a conversation with Max Bone, who also doubles as a student at the Elliott School of International Affairs in Washington, D.C. I am honored to be able to share the conversation that I had with Mr. Bone in this episode, and I want to underline before moving to that conversation that, again, this is the North American Francophone Podcast. I was looking for a North American voice to speak to African issues, or at least how they are perceived by those who work on the policy relating to Francophone African countries. With that point established, Mr. Bone is an incredible resource who works very closely with the Senegalese population in Washington, D.C., as well as other Francophone African populations in D.C. And so now I'll turn to that conversation and hope you enjoy all of the dialogue that we shared together. Thank you again, Max, for coming on to the North American Francophone podcast. And I'm just wondering how you got interested at first in African affairs.
Well, I've been really, as far back as I can remember as a child, very much interested in international affairs. I think it actually originally came from an interest I had in ecology and biology when I was just in elementary school. And eventually that led to me learning about different parts of the world and in particularly Africa. And I'd say towards the end of elementary school and through middle school, I became much more passionate and interested in African affairs. And I was first able to travel to Africa, to Ghana in particular, which is obviously an Anglophone country in Africa, in 2014. And ever since then, I guess you could say I've been hooked. I've been very fortunate to go back and forth to the continent, to both North and Sub-Saharan Africa, multiple times, and to really focus both my academic and professional career on matters concerning the continent.
Great. And I see that most recently the Africa Center for Strategic Progress, where you're working as a research fellow, and also working with Reach Out Cameroon as vice president of the board of directors. Could you talk a little bit about maybe those two experiences and how they've shaped your way of viewing African countries?
Absolutely. So they're two very different initiatives, but they really each get at some of the major issues facing the continent today and also my areas of passion. So I will start out with the Africa Center for Strategic Progress. It's a startup think tank of sorts that is headquartered here in Washington, D.C., but we have a presence in Kenya, Cameroon, and an array of other countries across Sub-Saharan Africa. And what the real aim of ASTRAP is to empower the youth across Africa, particularly in universities, to do academic research with an emphasis on quantitative analysis and data, because there's a lot of great work being done on Africa right now, but it's predominantly coming from outside of the continent. And while there is obviously a place for that, and it plays a very important role, it is also very important to engage the youth in Africa, because Africa is a very, very young continent. And in almost every single country in Sub-Saharan Africa, the majority of the population is under the age of 18. So they are going to be the future of the continent, but unfortunately, they're not being engaged as much. And even where they are being engaged, there's many good examples that across the continent, their voices are not being placed at the center of the debate. So there's a lot of discussions here in Washington and across the world about how to engage the youth of Africa, and a lot of people are actually calling it unexploded ordnance, because the youth of Africa can either play a role in stabilizing the continent, should they be given opportunities, jobs and whatnot, or it could be a destabilizing factor, as has been seen elsewhere. And ASTRAP's goal is really to engage the youth of Africa, their ideas, and allow their voices to be placed at the center of the policy debates and discussions. Reach Out Cameroon, it's a Cameroonian NGO, as you can tell by the name, and I first got involved with it as a volunteer and then as a consultant working on the ground. And I first came to Reach Out Cameroon in the fall of 2017. I was interested in Cameroon for a variety of reasons, including the linguistic divide there, which has its roots after World War I, when it previously was German Cameroons, and then it was divided between the British and the French. It was divided into three colonies, actually, British Northern Cameroons, British Southern Cameroons, and then French Cameroon, which was part of the broader French colony encompassing parts of Western Central Africa. And after World War II, when a lot of decolonization began and the United Nations was created, the two British colonies, British Northern Cameroon and British Southern Cameroons, held plebiscites, so basically referendums, to determine if they would become part of either Nigeria or part of Cameroon. And British Northern Cameroons actually opted to become part of Nigeria, while British Southern Cameroons opted to become part of what was then the Republic of Cameroon. And it became part of Cameroon under the auspices that it would have a federal system government. So there would be large levels of local autonomy. Also, they would be able to keep their British traditions, especially regarding law, education, and of course, the language. But the federal system of government was abolished in the 1970s. The country's name was changed to the Republic of Cameroon. And ever since then, actually, the Anglophone population has been systematically marginalized by the Francophone majority in the country. And this has flared up multiple times, particularly in the 1990s. There were demonstrations in Anglophone Cameroon for a return to federation. The government denied that demand. And then there was talk beginning of independence, seceding from Cameroon and creating a state in what used to be the colony of British Southern Cameroons. But that really died down and it sort of became a fringe movement in the diaspora. But this again picked up in the fall of 2016 when teachers and lawyers in the two Anglophone regions of Cameroon, the Northwest and the Southwest, were actually protesting for more English-speaking judges and English-speaking teachers to be appointed. So Cameroon, it's very centralized system of governance where appointments down to the principals of schools at times can be decided at the ministerial level. And a very large issue was in the two English-speaking regions, teachers were being sent there that did not speak English. They would speak Pidgin, which is sort of a Creole version of English, I guess you can say. It's a mix of traditional English and traditional indigenous languages in that area, be it Bakweri or other languages. And they were not able to communicate with the students. And they would be teaching them in French, and the students wouldn't understand French. And the same thing was happening in the courts with the judges. And then the teachers and lawyers were repressed. Some were put in jail. Others were killed by the government when they weren't even demanding pluralism at that time. They were just demanding linguistic rights for the Anglophone minority in the country. And eventually, as happens when a government is repressive to peaceful movements, they become more extreme. And then there was the demand for federalism. Demonstrations occurred. That was repressed as well. There were two major internet blackouts where the two Anglophone regions were completely shut off from internet. VPNs weren't even working for a period of time. And this really accumulated in the fall of 2017 when the people really decided, okay, we aren't going to be able to get linguistic rights as part of Cameroon. We need to have independence. And what's really interesting here is how it was the diaspora driving a lot of this. Some people who had been involved in the 90s with independence activism and others on the ground that were empowered by the internet blackouts and the arrest of people. And there were actually demonstrations in the Northwest and Southwest regions of Cameroon calling for an independent state by the name of Ambazonia. And the government, again, cracked down, killed many. Amnesty International and some other international organizations say only 17 were killed that day. It was the beginning of October of 2017. But if you talk to people on the ground, some of them believe upwards of 1,000 were killed. In reality, it's probably a few hundred. But after this, it turned into a violent struggle where Anglophone citizens began taking up arms. And it's really fascinating because it is a linguistic conflict. And this is when I came in the fall of October 2017, and I watched as the situation deteriorated. And then I finally went in June of 2018. And what shocked me the most, Claire, is I was told, no matter what you do, you're on the ground here, do not speak French. Because people would, because it was becoming a linguistic war, and it was done on this linguistic identity. And people would say, oh, they'll think you're a French spy, they'll think you're an agent of the government. And if you speak French, you could actually be kidnapped or killed. And there have been people who have actually been killed by secessionist forces, rebel groups, really, for speaking French. And wow, the same can be said in the English-speaking region, the Francophone regions of Cameroon now with people speaking English. So what Reach Out Cameroon does, it does not work on the politics of this conflict at all. I do that on my own in my personal capacity. But what Reach Out Cameroon is doing a lot of now is a lot of humanitarian assistance for displaced people, because upwards of 500,000 people have been displaced, most of whom are in the bushes. But what was really fascinating for me to see is how in the office of Reach Out Cameroon in Buya, which is the capital of the southwest region of Cameroon, and what the rebels, secessionists, say will be the capital of their state, there were Anglophones and Francophones working in the office. And it was really interesting to watch how they interact and watch the languages that were being spoken in the office. And as I'm sure is no surprise to you, Claire, I would oftentimes try to speak French with someone who I knew was Anglophone to see how they would react and whatnot. And it was, oh, we don't want this. We don't speak French here. And what I also found just fascinating is Anglophone Cameroonians would refer to Francophone Cameroonians as French people. And I would say they aren't French people. They're Cameroonians. They're citizens of Cameroon. And then what they started talking about is how during colonization, the French would try to make a lot of the local African populations be more French in their identity and in their culture. And so they were actually calling them French people. They would call them Francophone Cameroonians. They'd say French people. And to this day, the secessionists refer to Cameroon as French Cameroon, or what they oftentimes say now is La République, which is, I mean, that's technically the name of Cameroon, La République du Cameroun. But it's just fascinating, the linguistic aspects of this. So in a nutshell, that's a lot of my work on the conflict there now.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that just amazing portrait of what you're doing. You know, as North Americans, when we are focusing on Francophone Africa, we often think about the rise of French in Africa. So 2016, for example, Kinshasa had about 12.1 million inhabitants, and it became the largest French-speaking city in the world, surpassing Paris, which, you know, has around 10.9 million inhabitants, or had 10.9 million inhabitants in 2016. It's interesting to hear sort of this tension, because I feel that from the perspective of, say, for example, French departments in universities in the United States, we aren't really hearing about these conflicts at all on our side of things.
Yeah, no, not at all. And what's actually really interesting, too, is the dynamics of Francophone Africa, and also the relationship between Africa and France. Oftentimes, there's a very strong belief, and there's some validity to it, but not too much, about the France-Afrique still existing today, and France still having very large influence and a certain degree of control over the countries. And how you mentioned Kinshasa, this is a particularly interesting example, because at the very beginning of 2019, in January, there were presidential elections in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And it's a long history. The elections were supposed to take place in 2016, and they kept getting delayed. The incumbent, who was term limited, was trying to maneuver and run again. He wasn't able to, but they ended up rigging the election to not make it so that the candidate of the political party of the incumbent would win, but actually the incumbent party made somewhat of a backroom deal with one of the two main opposition figures running. And an opposition figure by the name of Felix Tshisekedi won the election, but it was very clear that it was fraudulent and rigged. And a very large critique of France in Francophone Africa is that the French are supporting dictators and supporting autocratic leaders, electoral autocracies. But one of the first people to actually come out and say, oh, this election is rigged, was the French foreign minister, Le Drian. And so the French foreign minister was on French TV, I don't recall the channel, that night, and he actually said, no, this election was rigged. And what I found very fascinating was some Congolese colleagues and friends of mine were saying, oh, this is neocolonialism, they're interfering in our elections, when in reality, the French were in line in that case with the majority of the Congolese people, saying that Martin Fayulu won the election. But I think that this just goes to say and really show the complexities in the relationship between France and Africa today, and also how the historical legacy still has a very large impact on the ethos of a lot of societies in Francophone Africa. And oftentimes today, in political science and French departments as well, it's overlooked. the historical legacy. We assume, oh, colonialism's a thing of the past and we've moved on, but it's still at the center of how a lot of African societies see themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we focus on Africa as a new world center of innovation and growing populations and a key world region that has a lot of business leadership, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your interactions with leaders, but also people who are from Francophone or conflictual Francophone areas in the Washington, D.C. area as well.
And so it's very fascinating. Washington, D.C. actually has very large communities from several Francophone African countries. And when I was doing work earlier this year, actually, beginning of the year, with a think tank called the Atlantic Council, we hosted heads of state from multiple African countries, Francophone African countries. We hosted Félix Tshisekedi, who won the Congolese presidential election. We also had the prime minister of Mali. He's not prime minister anymore. The government fell, but he was at the time. And what was really interesting to see is how the diaspora was so engaged. And we had to set up all these plans and whatnot for diaspora leaders tried to come in who weren't allowed. And there in the past had been demonstrations outside of the events when Francophone African heads of state came. But this really gets into the role that the diaspora plays in African politics, particularly in Francophone African countries. Of course, there's much larger diaspora groups in Paris for some countries, but there's a lot of Cameroonians in the DC area. As I mentioned, there's a good amount of Malians. There's a lot of Congolese. And so it's very interesting to see how, despite the fact that they live in the United States, they're very active, particularly on the political front in the countries where they originate from. And this is particularly interesting in cases where the governments are more autocratic, such as Cameroon's a good example. The Republic of the Congo is another one, Equatorial Guinea to a lesser extent, where the diaspora really is mobilizing for democratic political change in the country. And it really just shows how globalization is not only affecting, you know, what we'd consider Western and developed societies, but also many countries in the so-called global South. But what I find particularly interesting with the case of Africa is the role that a lot of diaspora members play in innovation on the continent. This is particularly the case with tech and with IT and startup businesses in Africa, because a lot of Africans, particularly from Cameroon, Senegal, and other Francophone African countries who've moved to the U.S. have actually become very large figures in the IT industry, because it doesn't require a college degree and you can make a very good living. So what a lot of them have actually done is go back to their countries of origin, be it Cameroon, Senegal, the Congo, and start establishing tech startups. Jumia is a large one. There's many others that are really model Amazon, eBay, and various tech companies here that are really transforming the continent and also giving opportunities to a lot of the youth.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that as well. You know, underscoring the fact that Africa is such a young continent, many of these people are going to be up and coming in the next 20 and 30 years in the IT industry, as well as some other industries, I am sure. But I wanted to switch gears a little bit as we wrap up this interview and ask you one other question, really directed more towards you in understanding how you interact with people in the policy realm and in the international affairs realm.
What language are you going to be using with them? Are you going to be dialoguing mostly in English? Will French be used? And how does that work when we're thinking about sort of the complexities of French in a place like Cameroon, but on American soil?
Overwhelmingly French, because the one thing is that in every region of Africa, East Africa somewhat, Burundi or Rwanda, depending what region you consider them in. Every region of Africa except South Africa, there are Francophone countries. And what this allows for is almost like a lingua franca, where people of different nationalities who have different native tongues, even with in African countries, there's a lot of different native tongues depending on tribal balance and whatnot. It's a common language where people can communicate with each other. So with a lot of work I do with civil society activists who are working on matters of democratization and governance in Africa, French actually serves very much as a common language that we could all speak. And of course, it's not Parisian French or French that would you'd hear on the streets in France, unless you're in African communities. It's different. There's different pronunciations, and sometimes there's local or tribal words thrown into it, but it really does serve as a lingua franca amongst which different groups can communicate. And another really interesting thing, in the past, and to a lesser extent now, I've done a lot of work on North Africa, in particular Morocco. And in Morocco, a lot of people actually don't want to speak French because they see it as a colonial legacy. And I have many Moroccan colleagues and friends who are young and actually do not speak French. They speak English. And even if they do speak French, they would prefer to try to speak English, or with me, they'd speak Darija, which is a local version of Arabic. But what I found very fascinating is in interactions between North Africans, be it Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and sub-Saharan Africans, French serves as a linguistic and cultural divide, because there's a lot of history behind this, but there's very much a divide between North Africans and sub-Saharan Africans. And interestingly, they've the divides have been bridged to a certain extent, and there's a lot of work to be done there still, but French does serve as a common language for the two to come together. And as Africa becomes more interconnected, because people don't realize this, but a lot of African countries have more trade with the United States, Europe, and China than they have with their neighbors in other African countries. And this is starting to change. And as Africa becomes much more interconnected, French and English as well, but French especially, is playing a much larger role in a common tongue that a lot of people can communicate with each other in.
Thank you very much. This was, again, Maxwell Bone. He is an aspiring foreign affairs professional focusing on international politics in Africa at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and the African continent at large. So thank you again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much, Claire. It was great talking with you.
And thanks to you, our loyal listeners, for listening to the North American Francophone Podcast. I'm excited to announce that we now have a website, so go over and visit thefrancophone.com. We'll be having a store there in a couple of weeks, and we'll have all of the podcasts there easily accessible. Until next time!